Perhaps just by starting off, I'd like to just talk about a few anniversaries. Now, last Friday was the 93rd anniversary of Anzac Day, a great celebration, but in reality we celebrate what was a disaster. It's also this year the 150th anniversary of the Melbourne Football Club and the Richmond Football Club, and if you say that they haven't collectively won a grand final for 72 years, if that's not a disaster, what is? And I'd also like to say it's also the 60th anniversary of the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme starting in 1948. And I think it's been a great success for the Australian population in delivering health outcomes. But as we've seen today, there's a lot of challenges coming forward, particularly in terms of the ageing population. And I want to talk about some of those issues. A lot of the slides I'm going to start off with have already been discussed, so I'll be very brief. Coming back around, I'd like to also talk about how we're going to be paying for some of the new technology, particularly in the areas of oncology, where you're looking at drug treatments that are in the $30,000 to $40,000 a year. And I'd like to probably have a bit of a philosophical discussion around something like that. And I think in Melbourne, you can have a philosophical discussion. If it was in Sydney, if you weren't, you'd have to be talking about real estate, sex or money. So I look forward to having that discussion. And I also want to introduce an arcane term that Lisa is probably well aware of called qualies. And I'll come back and talk about that because that's what it comes down to, how we make some of these judgments. So I'd like to sort of expose some of the mysteries going forward. So again, a little bit of repetition in terms of what the impact of ageing is. And it's just interesting to note, 2 years ago, the first baby boomer retired. So we have this huge wave of baby boomers retiring. Now, we've been talking a lot about the silos within the health system. I suppose one thing that we actually haven't been talking about is health versus retirement versus productivity. And all those linkages tend to also operate in silos. And I think going forward, with a declining workforce participation rate, you know, one of the challenges is how do we actually maximise the investment we put into our workforce and keep people working? And obviously making sure that they're healthy will be one of the solutions. Now, Lisa talked about the declining fertility rate. I think probably if GSK is any example, we've had a huge outbreak of pregnancy over the last couple of years, and probably fertility rates have trended up. But just to me, a simple observation is I have two children who are in late teenagers. They participate in triathlons. And if there's any sport you want your kids to be in that'll make sure you'll never be able to afford to retire, triathlons are those. When I go along and watch them, I'm in my early 50s. Most of the other parents are in my early 50s. If I went back 30 years ago when my father watched me being a newbie on the football field at 13 or 14, most of the parents would have been under 35. So, you know, there's been this quite dramatic change in the age profile. And it also reflects the fact that most women are now not having their first child until they're at least 30. So that's actually delaying and also reducing the amount of babies that will be born. The demographic impact, again, Lisa showed that, and we talked about the coffin and what's coming along, the increasing preponderance of people 65 and over, and that does come back to the issue around labour force productivity. How do we keep people employed? If we look at the graph for Australia, I mean, that's got some nasty implications. If you look at the equivalent demographic graph for somewhere like Japan, where they actually have no migration, you know, potentially in the next 50 years their population will halve. Developed countries like Italy and so on also face the same issues. So their challenges of funding health are going to be quite dramatic. And that's why we're coming into these health technology assessments that Lisa talked about. Now, is ageing a threat? There's quite a debate about when, in fact, we incur the costs. And I think as Rowan very demonstrated with Fred, you know, the amount of costs that was spent in Fred in the last 5 years, we work on the basis that we expect 80% of the costs a person will incur over their lifetime in their terms of their medical costs will be in the last 5 years. Now, the fact that people are living longer, does that mean we start incurring those costs at an earlier date, or are they healthier longer and we're still pushing that back to the last 5 years? And I think the jury is probably out on what actual impact that is. Now, the PBS, before I go into this, I'm just going to ask for a little bit of interaction here, because the Treasurer, our past Treasurer, Peter Costello, and I must put the past Treasurer, used to focus very much on the PBS as being the thing that kept him awake at night. And there was an intergenerational report that highlighted if the PBS continued to grow, we'd end up spending more on the PBS than probably any other budgetary budgetary item. And so he was very much around, we need to change the PBS going forward. And this was a mantra of his. Now, I just want a little bit of interaction here. Rowan spoke about the cost of the health, how we spend $86 billion on health each year. Who here thinks that of that $86 billion we spend, over 50% is within the PBS? We spend over 50% of that on drugs. Anyone think 40%? 30%? Couple coming up. 20%? 10%? Under 10%. It's actually under 10%. And that's just some of the issues that I'd like to just briefly explore and then get into what are some of the options for funding access to medicines going forward. That shows there has been a dramatic increase in the growth of the PBS over the last decade. And particularly in the early 2000s, there was a huge jump that reflected two products coming onto the market that actually grew by 10 times greater than was expected, which Andrew would know Treasury hates something like that. One was our product, one was Celebrex. So that led to some measures taken to rein in the growth. But as you look at it, over the last 4 years, the PBS growth has really moderated from what was around 15 to 18% to single digits. And one of the big issues that is actually coming up, looking to the future, is in the next 4 years, there's going to be, the patent is going to expire on some of the major drugs that are currently in use. And there's an expectation on a global level that that'll save something like $200 billion. Lipitor, the anti-cholesterol drug, is currently the largest selling drug in the world. It's a Pfizer drug. It's about $12 billion a year. That goes off patent in 3 years. The expectation is Pfizer will be lucky to get $2 billion a year when that goes off patent. The generic companies will move in. Unfortunately for Pfizer, they don't have a replacement product, so that's causing quite a degree of shareholder pressure upon. Also, this comes back to the percentage of the GDP of the PBS. It's actually falling. The intergenerational report that Peter Costello used to talk about had it going out to about 3.5% by the year 2040. That was simple extrapolation of those years when there was high growth. It is actually under 10% of the total healthcare budget. Now, coming back to, I'll be very brief on that because we've had a lot of discussions around what's driving the uptake of technology. You know, new medicines, better diagnosis. It's interesting within the pharmaceutical industry, last year $43 billion was spent on research and development. Typically takes something like 12 years to bring a product to market. At best, you'll have a patent life of 20 years, so you've got 8 years where you have to make your return. 3 out of every 10,000 molecules that you start off with in the discovery stage actually make it onto the market. Last year, the FDA in the US only approved 23 new chemical entities. That's the same number that they approved in 1996, despite the expenditure on R&D in 1996 being something like $10 billion. So the whole industry is struggling with this productivity issue, more money into R&D, but actually coming up with the new products. It's a question of have the low-hanging fruits been picked. David, you're probably a better judge than me on some of those issues. There's been a lot of talk about the promise of genomics. The industry's actually struggling to put that into place. Then there is the demand, and there's strong correlation, as we've heard, around rising incomes and rising demand for health. And it's quite interesting. We've been talking about the primary healthcare sector. You know, some people have actually said the primary healthcare sector has actually even moved forward. And it's when you go to a spa or you go to a massage, that is actually part of the primary healthcare sector now. It's not the GP. So there's been quite an explosion in where people are getting their health services from. And we've talked about lifestyle, and the 80% of our expenditure is on chronic disease. Probably one issue I'd take with Lisa talked about obesity and diabetes essentially being a disease of the elderly. It has been in the past, but there's been that rapid movement now where it's actually becoming increasingly a disease of middle age. And in the US, they're having cases, quite a number of cases, with kids 15 or under who are actually getting diabetes type 2, which just relates to their fitness and their health. So there is obviously demand for the PBS. The government, the past government, has put in place some measures that will take effect from the beginning of August, where they're actually going to look at dropping prices on products where there's generic competition. And I think that's something GSK has applauded, because we have quite a strong pipeline of new products. And we would rather see the government funding the new products and making the savings from the old products. So that's actually going to keep that growth rate, that's going to stay at that plateau because of the cost savings. But it does also come back to what Andrew was talking about. The PBS is very much a regulated system. And currently, if you bring in a product that's a generic product that's equivalent to a product already on the market, and you want to lower your price, everybody else in that category has to lower their price. Now, simple economics would say you don't do that. And so that's one of the reasons why in Australia we pay prices for generics that are very high by international standards. These changes that are going to take place from August, by regulation, will start bringing us into parallel with other markets. But just looking in terms of where the pressure is coming within the PBS, it's increasingly in the area of these specialised high-cost drugs, oncology in particular. These are areas where you have a very small targeted population. You still end up paying the $1 billion in research. You need to recoup your cost back across a small population. So whilst the PBS has only been growing at 4 to 5% if you take out the high-cost products, the high-cost products have actually been increasing at 20%, and that's forecast to go forward into the future. We have a product for the treatment of late-stage breast cancer that will be listed tomorrow. We expect it will cost the government around $10 million. It'll be the benefit to 300 to 400 patients. That's the nature of where the industry is going to into the future. So I just want to come back and talk a little bit about how are we going to fund these products going forward. This is the philosophical discussion. You know, what are the community expectations of the pharmaceutical benefit scheme? And I think at the end of the day, people expect to have access to new medicines rapidly. We expect there to be equitable access within Australia. We've talked about the Indigenous issues. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you're on Footscray or if you're on Toorak, you can have access to the same product. The government certainly wants budget certainty going forward, understanding of what the costs are going to be, support the economic objectivities, keep people in the workforce, keep that labour force productivity up, and the ability to treat patients appropriate to the circumstances. Now, I don't think you'll find at the end of the day as many Australians would argue that that's what would argue against expecting that from the PBS going forward. Now, if you look at wanting to reform the PBS, reform access to medicines, and internationally there's a whole lot of different approaches towards accessing medicines, I think in Australia the expectation again would be that you expect the PBS to play the central role in delivering medicines to patients. I don't think there's any demand to change that. Access should be based on medical need, and we also need to recognise the comprehensive benefits that medicines provided. Lisa was talking about some of the work of Frank Lichtenfeld in the US, who's talked about what has been the reduction in, say, cholesterol levels, heart attacks, keeping people in the workforce. And we need to look at issues around the access and choice of patients and prescribers. But at the end of the day, in terms of where we want the PBS to go, as we face some of these pressures of the ageing population and the new drugs that are going to come forward, we really need to have a community discussion around the value of health and also what kind of society are we. And some of the options that you can look at if you want to increase the funding availability to the PBS, I've just talked about these, and change doesn't need to be threatened. So the cost, the savings that the government is doing by introducing these reforms to generics to bring their pricing down to international levels, they think that'll save something like $800 million over the next couple of years. So that's a significant amount. I think Lisa was also talking about how doctors are very strictly controlled in terms of how they can prescribe products. So a couple of years ago, we had a product for diabetes type 2 prescribed. If a doctor wanted to prescribe that for a patient, he had to get their blood sugar level, and then he had to ring up the HIC and to get approval to put them on to that product. That, at that stage, was taking up to half an hour to get that approval. The unfortunate thing around that was doctors gave up because they don't have time to do that, and they left patients on other products that you would argue weren't necessarily best for the treatment. But that's the nature. There's a lot more restrictions on how doctors prescribe, and that's expected to continue to grow. And it's not just in Australia, it's a global trend. But some of the options, if you want to come back about how do you actually put more money into the PBS, and one thing to note is the PBS, the majority of people who make use of the PBS are actually those who you'd say are retired, chronically ill, disadvantaged. They access about 80%. They're also the people who pay the concessional payment. So about 80% of the access actually goes to those people who only pay 20% of the cost. So, I mean, that's one of the beauties of Australia, that we're prepared to support a system like that to provide equity of access, recognising that the cost falls on a different sector of society. But some of the options, if you wanted to go forward, is we currently pay co-payments. And I'm sure most people in this room would be paying $30 for a script, or $31 for a script. Those on concession pay under $5. Now, you could look at restructuring the co-payments amount so that it was actually related more to, say, what your income level was going forward. So those on a higher income pay more. But given that 80% of those people who use the PBS are those on the concessional, that's not going to raise a lot of money. One radical solution would be to actually say, why does somebody who, say, looks after their health, who's fit, doesn't smoke, eats well, why are they paying the same level of co-payments, or maybe the $30, for somebody who doesn't look after themselves, suffers from chronic disease, and gets access to medicines at $5? Do you want to actually change that mechanism? Now, that's quite a society issue, but, you know, these are some of the issues that we should at least be aware of. Other approaches, if you wanted to look at increasing the funding, is we all have a Medicare levy at the moment. Would you actually want to add on a medical savings account that could not only pay for your drugs, but also could pay for implants, a whole range of other medical funds? And this is what they do in Singapore, and it's a compulsory savings account. It pays for about 30% of people's medical costs, and they work on the basis that if you start paying this medical savings account levy when you're 20, generally by the time you're 30, you've raised enough money that then compound interest will cover you for the period going forward. Those kind of arrangements, however, you do need to have a provision for catastrophic issues. If you're hit by a bus, no, there's no way you're going to be able to save enough money to cover all the treatments that then would be the case. The PBS levy, and there's a number of other left-field options. You could actually come back, and I suppose it's quite radical, you could come back and reintroduce death taxes. If people over the last 5 years of their life incur quite high medical costs, as we talked about with Fred, you could come back and say, well, is that going to be some form of death tax? It'd be an extremely brave government that would want to introduce that kind of concept. But at the end of the day, the real question mark going forward will be around oncology funding. And this is where this concept of QALY comes in, which is quality-adjusted life years. And the health economists, in assessing the uptake of new technology, try to work out how much that will provide on the basis of an economic term. And generally within Australia, if you get up to $30,000 on a quality-adjusted life year, it'll be found to be fundable, and the PBAC will make that decision. Most oncology products are at least $80,000 a year, and if not more. And what has been the experience in the case of, say, products like Herceptin and so on, it has actually taken 3 to 4 applications to the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advising Committee and 3 to 4 years to actually get that funding approved. Last year when we had Tycurb, our breast cancer product, approved, we got that approved within the year. That's been the exception for oncology products. These are some of the issues that we're going to have to come back and say, because at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to get that $80,000 down to $30,000. The simple economics for the pharmaceutical industry to be doing the research into those products, at the end of the day, you need a return that's commensurate with the risk that you put into it. So that's the philosophical discussion where, as a country, I think we need to have some discussion around what kind of access do we want to have to medicines and expensive technology going forward at the end of the day. And having said that, I have no objections, and I'm a taxpayer at the end of the day. I agree very strongly with the concept of the health technology assessment. I don't want the government to be spending my tax dollars on a product that's not cost effective, and I have no objections with that. So I think hopefully that's just giving you an idea of some of the pressures, some of the issues within the pharmaceutical industry. It's a rapidly changing industry. It's under a lot of pressure because of a very dry pipeline. But in terms of where we want the PBS to go into the future, I think we, as a community, need to have some kind of debate, because it also comes back to what kind of community we are at the end of the day. So thank you.